Hello, and welcome to the 89th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Sunday, the 30th of September, 2018, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week, we welcome a new guest, Jamie Merchant, to the show. We talk about his recent essays critiquing market socialism in one country, published in the Brooklyn Rail Journal. But before that, I'd like to thank all the PayPal and Patreon subscribers. You too can help keep the revolutionary fires burning by becoming a Patreon or hitting that there PayPal donation button. If you'd like to leave a comment on the episode, please do so on the YouTube channel. I do my best to respond to all the comments. Okay, to the interview. So, Jamie, you've recently written an article called Dreams of National Capital, Market Socialism Past and Present. Would you like to give us an idea of what this was all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So this article, Dreams of National Capital, is an attempt to kind of come to terms with the revival of theorizing the idea and the concept of market socialism on the sort of radical left over the last maybe 7 or 8 years. We've seen what I think is a kind of renaissance in the idea of market socialism as a way to think seriously about the problems presented by the idea of socialist planning and to deal with the problems left over from the 20th century and the legacy of the Soviet Union and what people take to be the failures of that model. And kind of market socialism is a serious attempt. It's seen as a serious attempt to come to grips with the real challenges posed by those things that have been left over from 20th century and the legacy of the Soviet Union and all of that, and grappling now with, okay, so how do we do a socialist economy today if we were to think about it seriously and as a program? And so it's been getting a lot of uptake, and there have been a lot of really notable contributions to the idea. And I think there are just a lot of hidden, not really hidden assumptions, but just unacknowledged assumptions that are motivating it. And that's why I was sort of motivated to write this article, to kind of bring those assumptions to light and, shed some or subject them to critical examination.
Is this idea, this return to this idea of market socialism, is this kind of coming from the kind of Jacobin circle?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that the most notable, like the contribution that kind of kicked it off, was Seth Ackerman's essay, which I think is a fine essay from, I think, 2012, The Red and the Black, where he really brings like the idea of market socialism back up to date. Since then, he and some others have been kind of working within that frame in various ways. But I think it's a lot of it has been motivated by the circle around Jacobin and the Democratic Socialists of America in general, I would say.
Would you like to maybe explain maybe the origins then of national socialism? That's the wrong. I said, I'm going to get in trouble now. Market socialism.
The origins of the idea arguably go back to the classical socialists, the so-called Ricardian socialists in the early to mid 19th century, who were thinking about labor in a broadly kind of, Ricardian frame as, the source, the generator and the source of value, and the capitalist and the rentier as the figure who steals the value or skims off the surplus that the worker produces, and just keeps it for himself in an unfair exchange. And, people like Thomas Hodgkin and Pierre-Joseph Proudhon in France, although he was an anarchist, they took the free market and the sort of the ideal of free exchange to be, free market exchange to be a kind of natural complement to the laborer working, and receiving his fair share. That if you could just get rid of the sort of predatory behavior of the capitalists and the rentiers and so on, and you just had like a free market in labor, without that power structure on top of it, then, you know, the worker could get his fair share, could get his due, and it would be, everything would be fine. So that's kind of the origins, you know, if you want to go all the way back to that point. And you know, it's tied to the idea of the sort of classical, like, workers' councils and even sort of mutualism, if you get into the anarchist discussion as well. But what I would say is, like, maybe the earliest, or maybe as early as we'd want to go back for this conversation in terms of the roots. And then moving further up to the 20th century, and we can get more into detail about this stuff if you like, but you have the, you know, the famous socialist calculation debates, which took place in the, you know, roughly speaking, the 1920s, the 1930s, between, you know, some pretty famous Austrian economists and some socialist economists, one of whom was Oskar Lange, who made, you know, very explicitly the argument that, you know, markets can be mixed with some kind of coordinated planning regime in capital goods, in the means of production. And so you can have a market-coordinated, basically, consumption economy, consumer economy, so that people, it preserves people's free choice in the consumer economy, while having central planning, or at least a strong planning regime in the mode of production or in production goods, so that you can sort of iron out the contradictions and the irrationalities of, you know, the market's distribution of capital goods. So
this is the idea, yeah, that you would basically, the means of production, so the machines and all of that stuff, maybe the raw materials and stuff, are under a plan. And say the creation of the kind of consumer varieties of shoes or t-shirts or you name it, computers, that there's a market based on that. There might be 20 firms creating different types of computers and let the market decide what's best.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that in general, yeah, I think that's accurate. According to Lange's sort of, you know, scheme. Importantly, right, there was the shift from, you know, the labor theory of value, which was sort of the standpoint of the early, you know, the Ricardian socialists, the classical socialists, and their idea of what this program would look like, to Lange's proposal, which is based on, you know, the marginalist calculus and the kind of conceptual foundations of what we now know as economics. So there was a big epistemological, you know, transformation underlying that, but they're both in the same tradition of market socialism, I would say. So now that brings us up to the present debate, roughly. And just like in the early 90s, sort of after the, you know, the fall of communism and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, there was another big uptick in interest in the idea of market socialism as maybe the way forward for, you know, socialism, serious socialists in the present. Now, too, in our era of great, you know, upheaval and dissent and just political tension, we now have, again, a return to the idea of market socialism as the way forward for, you know, the socialist left. So this is kind of just a very broad and rough picture of the trajectory of that concept over the last roughly 100 years or so, 150 years.
And was market socialism tried in any of the Soviet bloc or the neutral communist countries?
That is an interesting question that I don't know. Well, there are a couple dimensions to that. One is, you can argue plausibly that the Soviet Union itself experimented, you know, both in the period of the new, you know, the new economic program in the 20s, shortly after the revolution, and then after the kind of the high Stalinist period of super tight central planning, and the period of kind of limited reforms that came after that, that the Soviet Union itself experimented with different, you know, mixtures of markets and coordinated planning in the economy over the course of its history. People are still trying to understand really what the Soviet Union was all about as a mode of production or as an economic formation or what have you. But, you know, people are still kind of asking those kinds of questions. Well, like, how fully planned was it really? Like, what role did markets have when, and, you know, how effective were they, and or market forms of exchange? And so so in the Soviet Union, you know, some people would probably want to argue that you did have elements of market socialism there. And then I think, you know, people like Seth Ackerman and the other people who are interested in this idea, they might turn to some of the more radical reforms that were coming out of the Eastern Bloc towards the end of the Soviet Union from, you know, economic reformers who were trying to, who understood the system was moribund and were trying to think about a way to revive the, you know, the socialist model or even the communist model by integrating markets into it. And I know that there was some ferment along those lines and market socialism, particularly in the area of a socialized, you know, capital market, and thinking about how financial capital can be part of a market economy system. There were some Eastern Bloc economists and theorists who were working on those questions towards the end of the lifeline of the Soviet Union. So definitely that the idea has been in play in the kind of, you know, the history of 20th century communism in various ways.
Getting back to this calculation debate, I've had Paul Cockshott on the show recently and a few times talking about calculation debate. He talks about how Kantarovich actually won that argument and, you know, proved that you can't have a state-planned economy and solve all the necessary equations. What did Hayek and these guys make of that?
Yeah, they, you know, were just to the end inveterate critics, I mean, as you know, of the idea that a central planning authority could satisfy the demands of a complex modern economy. I'm not familiar with Kantarovich, so I can't speak on his particular solution. But certainly Oscar Lange, who wrote very strongly and compellingly in the 20s and 30s on this problem, basically claimed to have shown that the laws of economics themselves, that a lot of classical liberals thought had invalidated the idea of socialist planning, actually are what made it possible. You know, as far as a lot of people are concerned, Lange then proved the possibility of a central planning regime that could work just as well or better than the market itself in allocating resources in a modern economy.
I think Kantarovich might have proved it from a labor hours point of view, as opposed to a marginalist point of view.
Yeah, I mean, for Hayek, the idea was that, you know, no planning, again, like we were just saying, no planning regime is able to satisfactorily carry out, you know, the needs for coordinating production distribution in a modern economy. And planning, in fact, if it is undertaken, even in the way that someone like Lange, or he would have said, you know, Kantarovich as well, I'm sure, thinks that it should be, it'll inevitably end up in some kind of coercive, in the worst case scenario, terroristic kind of regime. And you don't have to, you know, take it to the hyperbolic lengths that Hayek does, of course, you know, but he mounts a very consistent, it has to be said, you know, case for why central planning, the way it was conceptualized in the 20th century, might result in the kinds of coercive and just undesirable regimes that we saw in the communist bloc during the 20th century. That critique seems to have been, again, like the early 90s in a lot of ways, the Hayekian critique of planning regimes from the standpoint of the, you know, the infinite like wisdom and malleability and adaptability of the market has been, it seems to me at least, sort of taken over by the contemporary proponents of the idea of market socialism, insofar as they're making the argument that, you know, sort of in the exact same way that it's been made before, that, you know, some combination of markets and planning maybe is what we need in if we're going to be serious about socialism having any kind of future, you know, as an economic project or as a political economy. That's really kind of the core of it.
Why do you think they've swallowed this Hayekian line?
Because I think that there tends to be a trend of thinking about political economy and, you know, projects for socialist economics from, roughly speaking, a nationalist frame or a predominantly national frame. And this is why, you know, some contemporary advocates of market socialism see just the question of ownership, like who owns the wealth of a country. You know, is it the financiers or is it the workers? They see the question of ownership as central to what socialism means. Because they sort of reduce the question of socialism to ownership, it seems to them to make sense that, well, we could just sort of, I mean, this is another kind of version of market socialism that you see floating around by sort of forwarded by Matt Brunig, for instance, you know, a very prolific sort of policy analyst, also affiliated with the DSA sort of wing of the socialist left, that we could just take the, you know, the assets of the banks or the equities of the corporations and convert them into public property, make them owned by the state and basically take them into state ownership after reimbursing the people who held them privately, these assets or what have you. And then it becomes public property. And, you know, the pub, so again, it's kind of the market socialist scheme of like the public, you know, the citizenry owns the assets of society, but the market is going to be allowed to do its coordinating function to move the resources and the goods around and to efficiently allocate them. But that is an inherently nationalist scheme because it's taking the, you know, the citizenry, the legal category of the citizen, which is specific to right now at this point in history, just one particular nation state, you know, one country, and saying that they have ownership of the wealth produced by the country in which they live. And for a lot of people, it makes a lot of sense. You know, that's like, yeah, that's how it should be. I mean, that's how we get parasitic financiers out of the process. That's how we get, you know, shithead bankers out of the picture. Like this sounds quite good, but it's inherently nationalistic in the sense that it's a state driven process, right? It's about taking over assets that were once private, you know, socializing them and in the name of the citizenry, and combining that with, you know, the market coordination of the consumer economy.
Are they actually saying that they will compensate the people who they're taking the assets from? And in what sense could you possibly compensate the entire class if you're taking all of the ownership off them? Like, it's not like you've got new means of production to give them instead.
Yeah, the idea for the idea around that is, and this is where it gets into the more the contemporary debate, which is focused mostly on this kind of how to do this in a predominantly financialized economy, which is the right, like the, you know, the rich Western countries. What would market socialism look like? And the idea there, I think I mentioned it earlier, is you'd have something like a socialized capital market, where all the financial assets and equities and bonds and securities and so on that are owned by the you know, the companies and the investors in a particular country would be bought out by the state and made basically the foundation of a new socialized wealth fund. You might call it a capital market that then can be used, you know, to direct investment from the standpoint of the citizenry, from the public. But the idea is that you're not actually expropriating anybody. You know, like you, these assets are bought. They're bought and paid for. Nobody is, you know, just has their property expropriated without compensation. Everybody will be equally compensated. I think this is Seth Ackerman in the Red and the Black essay, which if you haven't read it, I'd recommend it. I think he gets into this in detail, sort of what this would look like. But yeah, the idea is that no one will, the owners won't be fully, you know, they won't be expropriated. They'll be compensated. Does that make sense?
It does make, I know what you're saying, but I just wonder in practice what it would actually mean. Like usually when things are nationalized, a lot of times they're nationalized at great discount,
yeah.
You know, and often expropriated. This is what made Mossadegh and Nasser and these guys so hated by the British.
Yeah, I mean the history of anti-colonial nationalization, yeah, I think is different from what the contemporary proponents of this kind of socialized capital market and market socialism have in mind. I think this is meant to be more of a smooth and, you know, not particularly abrupt or violent break. It's meant to provide a blueprint for a smooth a more or less, you know, continuous transition to a socialist economy is the way, at least the charitable way that I read it. it's not that, that doesn't mean it's not going to be, you know, something that has to be politically fought for very stridently, but yeah, it's meant to not be as directly hostile and antagonistic, I think, as like the old method of expropriation, which is, I think, what you're talking about.
Can we talk then about what it means within the global system, this idea of market socialism in one country? And also a little bit, can we discuss as well, because sometimes these discussions are very US-centric, what might be possible in one extremely large, powerful country? What does it mean for smaller countries?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of the critique I'm trying to mount here, is that it takes place from, obviously, implicitly from the standpoint of a very, you know, powerful and wealthy country like the United States, that would be in, you know, because of the power of its currency, the role of its banking institutions in the global economy, and the sort of, you know, the crucial position of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and all of that, would be in a position to carry out a major program of, you know, financial nationalization of this kind in a way that most other countries obviously will not. It's very much specific to this country and this point in time in history. There's a number of things you can say about that. I mean, I think there are major risks involved with nationalizing all the financial assets or socializing all the financial assets of a country like the United States. I get into this in some detail in the Fantasies of Secession article also. Part of the what I think is being overlooked in these proposals to nationalize financial assets on that kind of scale in a country like the US is what Marx called world money. Some might make the argument that the dollar, you know, it's because it's so unique and it's so powerful, and you know, it has its exorbitant privilege and all of that, as it's been labeled, that we can and should undertake this kind of form of financial socialization. But my argument is that what Marx meant by world money is that money is not just it's not just a unit of account, it's not just a convention of exchange. It's actually a mediation of these, you know, of these deeper interconnections of the social relations of production that connect all the countries, you know, in the global division of labor in the world economy together, you know, the United States included. The, you know, the extremely complicated interconnections, for example, between the Chinese and the American economy would need to be analyzed very carefully for, you know, how it would be affected, for example, by any kind of major scheme of financial socialization. Because really what you're talking about is the evaporation of literally hundreds of trillions of dollars in what Marx called fictitious capital, right? Like just claims on future revenue streams, financial claims that may or may not have anything real underlying them. But fictitious capital still gets baked into the system, right? As leverage, as on balance sheets, as means of payment, like, and all the rest of it. And so if you're talking about nationalizing all of the financial assets of a country like the US to return to its citizenry, you're essentially talking about what you're then talking about, I would argue, is what we should do in a context of like a generalized financial collapse. Because you're talking about on so grand a scale, this, you know, just this evaporation of world money and fictitious capital in a way that's really hard to imagine. And we haven't really begun to think through what the consequences would be, other than just to be like, oh, it'd be nice if the citizenry could have all its money back. But that's both what I would argue. I mean, that's both a very parochial understanding of what we as socialists should be after, which I think should be more of an internationalist program and vision. And it's just extraordinarily risky because it seems to me, yeah, it just, it raises all these sort of tricky questions about like, well, what's going to happen when capitalism itself breaks down? If the foundation of the world economy, if capitalism itself, which is arguably, you know, the US economy, the world, you know, the dollar, the Federal Reserve, that whole nexus is just pulled out from under it like a rug. You know, what's going to happen? How is the world economy and capitalism itself going to react? I mean, you know, the last time the entire global order broke down in a way that this would potentially lead to, we had, you know, the descent into World War, both as first and second iterations. And so the historical record is pretty clear about how bad it can get if capitalism is broken apart abruptly and violently. And so the question then becomes, what should we be doing instead as socialists? And that's where you start to get into the internationalism question. But that was a lot of stuff. Yeah, how do you feel about that?
I feel great. Nadia, one thing that I don't think is dealt with maybe that much by these people, not that I'm an expert in what exactly they've said, but would be, the role of the US military and imperialism in ensuring the conditions for capitalism and all these multinational companies, which are largely owned by American firms. Are we saying that there will be a rollback of military? And what would that mean for US capitalism? What would it mean for them? Would we see expropriation of US assets by other capitalist countries abroad? It seems like an incredibly complex issue.
Yeah, it raises a lot of these kinds of questions. And I think that's a relevant one, the one that you just raised. And
this idea, like, the capitalist class can act as an international class when it really needs to. If we look at how it reacted to, say, communism in the early 20th century or whatever. And if great irony was America went socialist, we would see the Europeans and everybody come together to try and defeat the American socialist country, just like they did with Russia.
Yeah, I mean, that has to be taken into account. Like, even if a country that has been the standard bearer of capitalism since its inception, the U.S., if a genuine socialist revolution were hypothetically to occur, I mean, what would be the reaction from the rest of the world? And, that, I think you start to get into tricky territory here, because it becomes a question of like, well, would that even really be imaginable happening in the U.S. if it weren't also happening elsewhere? Right. In any case, if it were just to happen, in one country, you always have to raise the question of what would be the backlash, what would be the response and the reaction abroad, both politically, militarily, and economically. And yeah, it's just like, this stuff is not at all, at least that I've seen, the best of my knowledge, I just haven't seen much grappling with these questions.
Even though it's not like communism, it's only market socialism, it's still a fairly goddamn revolutionary kind of policy to have.
Yes, true.
And if you're going to go all the way to do that, would you not want to just go all the way and do like fully automated luxury gay space communism?
I think there's something to be said for the reason I appreciate what the market socialist people are doing is because it is reviving this really important part of the radical imagination that has just been suffocated, for the last almost 30 years, since the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, of just, of thinking of bold and grand ideas, for changing our social foundation down, our social formation down to its very foundation. And there's a lot that's credible in that. But yeah, this is where it gets into, I think the unnecessary concession to Hayek, and that I think ties into what you're saying. Like, why do we have to cede the ground to Hayek on these questions about the necessity of retaining, the market with all of its alienating and, antisocial effects? Why don't we just sort of push the envelope further? And if we are assuming that we're in a general period of ferment and socialist kind of revival, which I would argue we are, though certainly gradual, then yeah, why not sort of go all the way and start thinking about, well, how can we really get what we want, which would be a world without, the alienating and antisocial results of market coordinated societies and all of the, all the ills they bring with them of, atomized individualism and feeling and isolation and just like ruthless competitiveness. All of that stuff. I know the market socialist advocates would argue that, well, the point of this is to have a society where those ill effects would be minimized as much as possible. But I think, your question gets at, and I think is valid, is like, well, like, why not just try to go a little bit further and just be a little more ambitious and think about what actually like a, like a post-market form of society could look like.
If there is, if they're talking about compensating the people whose assets have been taken from them, you still leave, in effect, a capitalist class. On some level, there's people there with billions of pounds, individuals. So what is the implications of, like, say, Jeff Bezos having $89 billion in his bank account?
Yeah. You know, what's he going to do with that?
Yeah, like, is he supposed to just spend it? Is that what we're saying? So we have, like, they can't put it into, like, means of production, so they all have to buy an incredible amount of yachts or have enormous estates.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, for sure, in terms of, like, in the case of Bezos and these kinds of people, like, I'm pretty sure there would be almost expropriatory levels of taxation, you know, in like a hypothetical market socialist regime that's genuinely aimed at an egalitarian restructuring of society. Like, you know, people like that would have their hair taxed off. Or Bezos doesn't have any hair, but, like, they'd be taxed severely, right? And so that would be one, I think, one response that market socialists might suggest. But it doesn't change the fundamental point of there being people, you know, people will still have a lot of this wealth. There will still be, you know, wealthy people if they're not going to be, you know, if they're going to be compensated rather than just fully expropriated. Yeah, it doesn't change that, and it doesn't write the you know, it doesn't do anything about the state, right? I mean, if you're talking about taking over all of the, you know, the financial assets of the wealth owning class and taking them into public property as the state, and this is what some do explicitly argue, you know, and putting it under state control, I mean, then that raises all of the problems of statism and, you know, how responsive the state bureaucracy is going to be to democratic input and the will of the majority. And once you start talking about those kinds of questions, it quickly gets pretty murky, you know, how democratic something like, you know, fully state overseen or state supervised market socialism is going to be.
I've just nearly finished a book by Mike McNair on revolutionary strategy. I don't know if you've read that book.
I have not, actually. What's he on about?
Well, it's really brilliant. It's a critique of the strategy of all the different various strands of radical lefts over the last, you know, 150 years, and try to put them into context. But one thing that he said that was very pertinent to this conversation was that capital as a system is an international system. And that if you want to have, you know, socialism or communism, whatever we want to call it, that the working class needs to organize and act on an international scale. It's just a reality of the system. And this idea of market socialism in one country is very much ignoring that reality of the capitalist system.
Yeah. And I mean, that's really that's the core of it. In their defense, I mean, I know, you know, the response would come back, well, you have to start somewhere, right? Like, how can we do this if we can't act nationally? You know, it's nice to talk about internationalism and how international capital is and all of that, but we have to start somewhere. You know, I think the responses to that point is yes, but the question then becomes, how do we articulate the national strategies and of the left in different countries with this broader shared international goal, right, of transforming the global economy into something that would be more egalitarian for not just people in the US, not just for the citizens here, or not just for the citizens in the UK and the wealthy countries, but for, like, workers who are contracted all along the supply chains, you know, of companies that are based in these countries. We're talking about hundreds of millions, or, you know, over a billion people around the world who slave away in, like, horrifying and depressing and debilitating working conditions in the factories that produce for companies like Amazon and Apple and all the rest of it. And it just seems a much stronger and more powerful left strategy to think in internationalist terms and to think about how the people in the wealthy countries, you know, that you and I are in, and the people that are dominated and exploited by these companies can be lifted up and empowered and given a chance at a decent life in the same way that we're fighting for it here in the rich countries of the West. when, you know, our lives are tied to theirs, our fate is tied to theirs. I mean, they, like the people who work in the supply chains of these multinational corporations are the people who put the iPads and the coffee mugs and the stupid shoes and all of that on our, you know, in our closets and on our desks like every day. And so how do we bring them into the picture? That's a whole big discussion to have. But one of the biggest problems I have with the market socialist strategy is that it effectively writes all of that out of the picture. You know, it makes it just about returning the wealth of the companies in a particular country to that country's citizenry. And that just seems to me a very narrow and at times parochial perspective.
How much is this idea of market socialism as a strategy or as a policy tied to the kind of material makeup of the members of the DSA?
That I'm not sure. Could you say a little bit more about material makeup? Like what exactly you mean there?
Well, I suppose, who are these people? What type of exposure do they have to communist thought? Are these people new converts, kind of like myself? But how much are they still stuck in a mindset of, you know, a kind of a narrow mindset and not a mm-hmm. deep vision of what socialism really is, how it's not just this a redistribution. You know, the Labour Party or Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders, they're talking about redistributing some wealth, changing the distribution of the share that goes to Labour from 57 to 63%. How much of the DSA, how much of this policy a function of the types of people who are in the DSA?
I see where your question is coming from. And I think when you put it that way, it is a function of the organization. Because the organization, as far as I sort of understand it, is a very self-consciously socialist organization, but a lot of the thinking and a lot of the program, the vision and the program comes down to a really deepened and radicalized form of social democracy and a focus just on what can be done in like a single country. And I think it's in large part, I think it's because the Marx that I take seriously and others, you know, that thinks about the question of value and the international law of value, and how it connects the different countries of the world into the same structures, that is always sort of suspended, or that perspective is always sort of suspended or not brought into the picture by the members of the DSA who write about these things. And a lot of that has to do with just the history of the DSA and its very strong sort of anti-communist streak, which has been there from the beginning, you know, with Michael Harrington, and, you know, from the very beginning, there's been a very strong kind of anti-communist bent to the organization, and frankly a quite nationalist orientation in the kind of DNA of the organization itself. And so I think the narrowly kind of national and maybe in some cases statist direction of this revival that we're seeing in market socialism and these kinds of proposals, I think it does have to do with the organizational genealogy of the DSA to some extent. But, you know, I don't know a hell of a lot about DSA, so I can only kind of comment in a cursory way like that.
Do they have any core critique of imperialism? And do they have any idea of withdrawing US troops from all over the world?
I think so. Yeah, I think they tend to be, again, just from my limited knowledge, and to the best of my understanding, I think they are pretty, you know, pretty strongly anti-imperialist, quite critical of the kind of permanent global US military presence. But again, I haven't read anything or come across anything, at least recently, that I could comment on in more detail. But yeah, but why exactly do you ask?
Well, because in Britain, the Labour Party were always very pro-imperialist. So when they took power, you know, post 1945, you know, they were involved in lots of shady operations all over the place. I think, you know, from, you know, places like Kenya and all Burma and all these places, you know, that the idea was for the Labour Party was that they can still have the colonies and they can use that to kind of fund socialism in the UK. And I wonder, when the push comes to the shove for socialist parties in America, how anti-imperial they would actually be if they saw that it could cause the standard of living to drop noticeably when they're not getting all these free meals from the colonies all over the world.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good point, especially, you know, if you think about imperialism now as predominantly an expression of the financialized sort of, if you want to use that word, although it's not the greatest word, but like the financialized global economy or the form of the global economy that we're in, and the way that, you know, a country like the US is able, and the UK as well, is able to extract, or at least appropriate, I should use that word, value, you know, from other parts of the world, in a serious way through financial circuits. Although I don't know, like, there's a big question to have about imperialism in general and how we understand imperialism in the present, and, you know, what exactly its role is, and the role of the US and countries like the UK and its position within contemporary capitalism. But in general, I think your instinct is a good one to ask about, like, well, you know, what are the presumptions that are being taken for granted here in this area by these guys? The point of the Fantasies of Secession piece is really just to make the case from the standpoint of, you know, financial capital and fictitious capital, and why it's not as easy as some seem to think that we'll be able to, you know, simply reappropriate all of the, you know, financial wealth of a country like the US back into like a revitalized social democracy or even socialist democracy. And even if we were able to reconcentrate all of that wealth just onto the citizenry of this country, you know, what does that mean for the people in the rest of the world who are dominated and exploited by the countries that give us the, you know, the commodities that we use every day? What does it mean for the undocumented people who don't have the benefits of citizenship, you know, and are going to be exposed in a way that could potentially very much empower, you know, right-wing forces? You know, if you're intensifying the logic and the value of citizenship over everything else, which is basically like what these programs claim to do, then it's not all that far from what Steve Bannon, you know, someone like Bannon would argue, which is just this very strongly economically nationalist program of, like, you know, it's not racism, it's not sexism, it's not xenophobia. Like, it's just purely maximizing the value of citizenship. You know, that's what Bannon himself has said. You know, if he's making that argument, and what the financial nationalization and market socialist advocates are saying is also in some way that they want to just maximize the value of citizenship, although, you know, with a left-wing emphasis.
Bent.
Yeah. Then that should raise some questions for us, right? Like, that should prompt some reflection and some introspection. Like, well, should we be this close to like a kind of Bannonist position? And that's the whole question of economic nationalism, which the market socialism piece was really sort of meant as like another critique of that broader trend of economic nationalism that I've seen on the left, and that I think is kind of pretty disturbing and very much in need of critique.
Well, thanks very much, Jamie, for coming on the show today.
Yeah, no problem, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and Anton Karas with the theme tune from The Third Man. Thank you for listening, and please join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.